the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina. It's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax, but buckle up, and let's wade into the deep end. What's really happening in your old North State?
North Carolina has the highest backlog of rape kits nationally. Today we are going to do a deeper dive into the rape kit controversy with AP Dillon. She's a writer and journalist here in North Carolina. We're going to look at the politics of all this, but we'll also pay attention to the advocacy and justice for victims and what that means. AP, Brooke, how are you doing today?
Great. Thanks for having me.
We're glad you're here, AP. So thank you for covering this. I know you've researched this extensively. You have written about it and brought it to the light. And now, just before we started recording, you mentioned that other outlets are starting to pick up and track this as well. But for our audience who maybe is unfamiliar with this, can you give us a little bit of history of, first describe what is involved with a rape kit, and then tell us why North Carolina seems to be so backlogged with dealing with these.
Well, the rape kits are exactly what they say they are. They're, you know, if you're assaulted, you're sexually assaulted, usually what happens is someone who is either a doctor, a nurse practitioner, or someone involved with law enforcement will take you to a facility where you can have a rape kit done on you, and it involves swabs of different parts of your body. On a female, it would involve swabs on her genitalia and places like that for DNA traces, for semen traces, for those kinds of things. And all that evidence, including any kind of particulates or anything that are on the body, are collected and they are put into a kit. And that kit will have to be tested for DNA against, you know, known rape offenders, known assault offenders, that sort of thing. Anyone that might be already in the criminal databases. And that testing can take time, and it takes money. And over the years, a lot of these things have been fallen by the wayside. And it turns out that there were over 15,000 of these about a year and a half ago when the advocates started to bring this question to the forefront. Once again, it had surfaced several times before, back in 2003, again in 2010, and again in 2016. This topic had been brought forward. There were 15,000 some odd sexual assault kits that were in custody. Attorney General Josh Stein said earlier this year, I believe it was, that about 800 of those kits have already seen testing and gone through testing. However, that's not really going to make much of a difference. There is a watchdog out there called End the Backlog, and they track the untested kits nationwide. And North Carolina, despite the 800 decrease in the number of kits being untested, we're still number one in the country. We're way ahead of all the other states,
including
California and places like that. I think California's next with 13,615, then Florida with another 13,400 and some odd.
So states Georgia, much larger than us by population.
Oh yeah. Oh,
and
yeah.
We're still number one.
And Attorney General Stein put out a press release and joined several legislators, both in the Senate and in the House, to put forward Standing Up for Rape Victims Act, or the Survivor Act, the Senate version of which has made its way through the Senate through various hurdles, and I think that it's probably going to see some passage. It's asking for up to $6 million, I believe, in additional funding over the next 2 years. And Stein also said that the governor's crime commission has given $2 million already towards these rape kits to be tested, and that his offices have secured a federal grant of $4 million towards the testing of these kits. It's just these untested kits weren't supposed to have existed.
Right.
This backlog was supposed to not be there.
Mm-hmm. And so what is this new bill that has been introduced? They're asking for $6 million in appropriation, mm-hmm, to test these. Have things like this been tried before? Has there been other funds going towards this, and that which led to those 800 previous tests being processed? Or is there ineptitude with how the money has previously been spent, and therefore there's I don't know. I'm just curious. That's what's the $6 million wicket. Going to do?
Yeah, that's a sticky wicket because I've been trying to trace some of the past funds that have gone towards this, and it all seems to get lumped in with the crime lab, and with procedures going on with the crime lab, and then with individual departments. Sometimes they allocate funds other places, or these were low priority, or there was a low chance that they were going to be actually prosecuted. And the prosecutorial percentage of these cases is very low as well. I think it's something like less than 2% of all of these cases that ever go to court actually result in a conviction. I believe that's what I was reading the other day. That was the statistic. It's kind of a sad state of affairs. So these things have become low priority. But I think it's important to realize that each one of these kits represents a person who was violated, a person who was wronged. And in many cases, it doesn't even represent an adult. It represents a child or a minor who was assaulted. And some of these cases, I believe a paper in Asheville uncovered that one of the rape kits that is untested there has to do with a minor who was assaulted.
I'm interested in this whole aspect because this was a big story during the campaign between Cooper and McCrory. I don't know if it was McCrory's folks running ads. They may have. And I know there were some outside groups talking about the rape kits. And it seemed like the story disappeared. I mean, you brought up advocacy groups and a website. But who is kind of sticking to this? Who are some of the folks covering the story outside of yourself that you've seen responsible in a good and responsible way? I mean, what is the public or PR sort of story out there about what's going on? And who's raising the most awareness in a good and effective way on this issue?
I haven't seen a ton of coverage on this story. I've seen the one that jumps to mind, the one who I've seen coverage several times in the last year is WRAL. They've had several stories citing the backlog issues and actually citing the past promises that this actually wasn't a problem.
Does Cooper talk about this as governor now?
No one has asked him.
Because, I mean, you brought this up, and I know this has been in the media. I've read stories about this, too, that Cooper said he cleared the backlog or he's addressed it better than any attorney general in North Carolina. He's made these statements, but is no one asking him at all as governor, as the chief executive of the state, you know, his role in alleviating this? I mean, you can point to him and say he failed as attorney general, but what's he doing, you know, from a legislative standpoint in terms of on this issue now? I mean, where is he pushing, and where is his outside of his buddy Josh Stein, where is, you know, the push from the executive office in North Carolina on this issue?
Well, the only thing we've seen on this from Roy Cooper's office has been out of his crime commission, and they have pledged $2 million towards resolving some of the current outstanding kits. Other than that, there has been no statement out of the governor's office about the backlog whatsoever, and I don't see anyone who's asked him that question so far.
A follow-up question, and you may not know this, because I don't know this, that's why I'm asking you, what are some model states out there? You know, we hear North Carolina is a bad example on a rape kit. Obviously, there needs to be some reform. Are there some model states out there that are doing this well, that are an example to hold up to North Carolina? I mean, what can we look to nationally as states that are leading on this issue?
To be honest, every single state has some outstanding kits.
Right.
I don't think there's any state that doesn't. I would have to do a little bit more research into that side of it. I really haven't taken a look at to see who's been doing it and who's doing it well and why it's working for them yet. I've sort of still been following the money trail on our side as to how it got this bad. and I still have yet to find a resolution for that. It seems to me that the amount of funding has been there, but maybe it wasn't enough at the time even, and also the fact that prosecutors are less likely to actually run with these crimes, that maybe that's why they were still sitting there untested. It's a multi-tiered question, and I think that it's probably as individual as the different law enforcement agencies who are actually collecting this information.
Yeah, and it'd be interesting to see, from my own respect, not to excuse any of the outstanding rape kits, but if there's any differences in prosecution rates in North Carolina on sexual assault crimes, whether it be rape or other forms of sexual assault, than other states nationally, if there's any sort of disparity there and if this sort of story has played into that to any degree, and I imagine it does to some extent, but I don't know the extent to that. And it'd be interesting because sexual assault crimes, my wife deals with investigations in the university level, not the criminal level, but it's, you know, notoriously hard to prove. And that's, I think, a reason to point why these rape kits are so important.
They are very important for that reason. And it's what's interesting to note is that I think the average cost is somewhere around $700 or $800 to test one of these kits. So, I mean, if we're looking at the full $15,160 that was cited by End the Backlog, and that was the original number that was produced in a 2017 report by the Department of Justice, I think you're looking at around $10 to $11 million. So the money that is being asked for right now is going to come close, but I don't think it's going to cover all of it. And I think it's also interesting to note the top cities in North Carolina where these things seem to be stagnating. I believe Durham was in the lead with over 1,700 of these. Raleigh was next up with over 1,400, and Winston-Salem had around 1,300, almost 1,400. So those three cities alone will be costing around $3.1 to $3.2 million just for testing in those cities alone. But those cities also have some of the more robust law enforcement divisions and some of the more well-funded ones.
Right.
I mean, look at Wake County. It's the capital seat. There shouldn't be this backlog in where the capital is, but yet here we have it.
So you have also, you cover a number of things in your investigative journalism. You've also talked and covered the teacher sex assault cases related to teachers and their students and things like that. And then also just anything related to parents and parental rights and students. So just thinking in that larger context, and I'm looking at this particular issue and knowing someone whose child in North Carolina, their young teenage daughter, was raped, and thinking about how there are thousands of untested rape kits still, and that the person that attacked her could have already been identified had we not had that sort of backlog. I mean, what is the kind and talking to that mother that had conveyed the story to me, and the utter frustration that she's experiencing as a result of just the state's ineptitude on this front. I mean, have you talked in your research, have you talked to any other parents or victims? Do you have any other background on people that actually really are impacted by these untested kits?
I've talked to one victim. It's very difficult to get people to talk to you about this. It's a very personal issue, and a lot of people try to put it behind them. But there was one victim who reached out to me after reading one of the articles that I had written and told me that she had been waiting on her rape kit for 7 years and that she had given up and she had actually moved out of state. So she hadn't had contact. She said something in like 5.5 years was the last time she had contact from anyone in law enforcement or in the prosecutor's office regarding her case. And I found that incredibly sad. But she said that she had made peace with it and that she didn't want to go on the record, that she just wanted me to know that the folks out there, a lot of them have been waiting for a very long time, and that if more people like her maybe came forward and there was a way to protect them and to protect their identities, that maybe there would be more pressure brought to bear on the powers that be, because she's just one person. Mm-hmm. And it had huge ramifications for her life. It impacted every relationship that she had. And she's moved on, but she hasn't moved on.
Right.
And I think that maybe she didn't say it in so many words, but that maybe if her kit had been finally been tested, it still hasn't been tested. If her kit maybe had been tested, that they might have found the person and that she might have been able to put a face with the, it was a stranger rape for her. She might have been able to put a face with what happened to her. She was attacked when she was actually in college here in North Carolina, and she's moved back to her original home state now. So, I think people need to understand that each one of these kits has a face that goes with it, and that there is an urgency here. And I think that Attorney General Stein is doing the right thing in trying to bring about more funding for it. However, I think that the powers that be who have not tested these kits, there needs to be more accountability on that.
Right. Level. Well, for so long, it seems like there was such a focus on denying that a problem even existed that it created this the conditions where this was able to fester rather than be dealt with head on. And that seems to be where some of the problem is, because it was, I'm reading your article that you wrote on this at battlegroundstatenews.com, and it's the North Carolina rape kit backlog continues to plague state's Department of Justice. And back in 2003, a spokesperson for then Attorney General, now Governor Cooper, said that there was no rape kit backlog, and that's what Ray had alluded to as well. So to me I see that as particularly troublesome, given the fact that now we're the leader in backlog and now we need all of this money. Now thankfully there is legislation that's been put forward to address this at this point in time, but again, how many could have been prevented, we do not know. As a result of these kits being processed quicker. But can you explain to us and our audience what the notification process is? How does someone know when their kit has been tested?
I do believe that they're notified. Usually if the results come in and they have a hit or they have a match, that's when they're notified. However, it depends on the different department doing it, the different law enforcement, their protocols. Each department has their own protocols, their own ways of going about and contacting them. Normally it would come through the detective or the contact person that had been involved in the case in the first place. That was what my person who contacted me, that's who she said had been in contact with her, was the detective in charge of her case. That was her point of contact going to and from. Prosecutors come and go. And also law enforcement comes and goes. She just happened to have a contact person that had been there for a long time and had stayed there for a long time. But I would assume that there are folks who have dealt with one detective only to have their case handed off to another one. And then after a certain amount of time, it becomes a cold case and you don't get contacted anymore. And if this kid isn't being tested to reactivate the case, then what happens at that point? Who's going to care at that point? It just sits there collecting dust. You know, and samples do degrade over time. I don't wonder if some of these samples maybe are going to come back as untestable because they've been sitting for so long. But that would be a question for a forensics person. I haven't delved into that too much. There is a certain amount of integrity that it is kept with these kits, but you know, some of them might have been collected at a time when the kits weren't quite as state-of-the-art as they are today. There's better methods for preserving evidence today than we had even a couple years ago. So who knows? I just think that this is a topic that should be a little bit more in the forefront heading into the next election cycle. I think that those who have been involved in the past with this really need to answer for the lack of action, the lack of initiative. If different departments around the state were not testing these things on a regular basis, I mean, what checks and balances are in place to make sure that this kind of critical evidence gets processed? And it speaks to the crime lab issues that Roy Cooper had, you know, going through. I think that goes all the way back into his early part of his reign over at the Department of Justice when he was the AG. There was the problem with the crime lab for a while there, and it finally escalated in the last few years that he was there. And that became a campaign issue during the 2016 election. And part and parcel of that is, you know, the rape kit backlog is you know, rolled into that back there. And to say that, you know, there's no backlog anymore or that things have been fixed at the crime lab, you know, have they really? This is what's been told to us. But now, you know, years later, we're finding out that this backlog still, it's enormous. We're number one in the country for something that we should not be anywhere near number one for.
One of the reasons this is so important, and we've alluded this a little bit already, but, you know, there's opportunities to solve other crimes through testing these rape kits, whether there's an assailant who's committed a crime somewhere else or to close crimes out. I mean, I think that's one of the big issues here is just knowledge, because a lot of DNA analysis now is being used to solve cold cases, to solve a murder in another part of a country and link all of these aspects together. But I would say sort of a question is, what are some areas, you know, we think of the sexual assault, first of all, but what are some important areas, too, about getting through and testing all of these rape kits in terms of, you know, also just an accountability that our government is doing their job? I mean, what other areas do we look to and see how they've messed up, and how do we advocate more? What I'm trying to say is, how do we push them and advocate them to do their job in a better way than they've done? Because, you know, we hear about stories, we don't necessarily pay attention, or, you know, I'm not a victim, so it doesn't really concern me. My family's not a victim. But I would like to know, what are some ways that we could push government on this? And part of that is the media, they need to do a better job of raising the perspective. But what are some ways that you've found successful just sort of pushing government on accountability? And so part of that has to do with information, but what do you think?
Well, I think in terms of accountability, we need to look at two things. We need to look at the fact that government is always going to be a broadsword and not a scalpel. And in some of these cases, we need a scalpel to dig down to the numbers that really matter. And I think reporting, mandatory reporting by all the various law enforcement branches across the state on statistics like this, on rape kit statistics, on assault statistics. I mean, they have statistics coming out the yin-yang. These kinds of things should be in reports that are put together and packaged on a monthly basis and sent off to, you know, Department of Public Safety or the Department of Justice or both, which can then be presented to the General Assembly so that they can be well-informed as to where the lag is and where they're going to have to plan for more resources, and make sure that this kind of backlog doesn't happen again. And, you know, also that would include, you know, manpower. You know, where are we lacking the manpower in certain areas? You know, where are we finding a deficiency? Where do we need to, you know, economize? Where can we change policies and procedures? Where's the best practices from the different states? You know, some of these things already exist, but I don't know that the level of sharing of this information is really happening the way it should be.
I'll have a follow-up question, too. Just you brought up an important point. You said this should be an important issue in the campaign in 2020, I would assume, for governor and for attorney general, too. And what are some ways that this can be raised to the level of getting more attention out there? Because some people might look at it and say, well, Cooper had this controversy when it was much bigger a few years ago, and it didn't really have any impact. I mean, he was elected governor, so the impact was probably very minimal on the campaign trail. I mean, what are some important ways that this issue can really be highlighted in a responsible way? I don't mean just, you know, in terms of partisan, Cooper's bad or Josh Stein's bad or Democrats are bad and they didn't manage this well. But what is a way that this can be highlighted on the campaign trail in a positive way, not necessarily a negative way where we just attack one side, but how do we sort of elevate it into a positive discussion in terms of solving this in North Carolina?
Well, I think it goes towards transparency for the first part. I think that is always a good campaign trail topic, is transparency and how you're going to use that transparency for the public good. I think during the 2016 campaign, Roy Cooper was more focused on which bathroom people got to use versus whether or not people were actually having justice served across the state, even though he was AG for 16 years. I do give credit to Josh Stein for taking up this mantle and for going forward with it, but it's also twofold for him. Number one, it's landed in his lap now, and he needs to take care of it. But number two, it's also helping to shield Cooper from any questions. As we noted earlier, nobody in the media has asked Roy Cooper any questions about this whatsoever. And I think that he needs to be asked about it. I think he needs to be asked, how come this backlog exists? You know, you basically handed this over to Josh Stein, and now, boom, we've got, you know, we're number one in the country for untested rape kits, really? That's a real issue. And I think that also it should be raised that the testing of these kits is really helping some people. I was reading an article the other day out of Charlotte that a 1981 cold case has been solved because of a tested rape kit. And they were able to find the perpetrator, and you know, there's prosecution ongoing now, and there's going to be closure in that case for those folks. So there's a positive side to this, that getting these things done is actually bringing closure to citizens all over who are living in uncertainty because their assailant hasn't been caught yet.
So speaking to that need for justice and the elections coming up, and this, you made some good points regarding Stein, his twofold role in this is, like you said, as sitting AG, he needs to deal with this now, and he's making steps toward that, thankfully. But also it shields Cooper from some of these questions. However, during the 2016 election, yes, HB2 and bathrooms were kind of taking center stage in the governor's race. But that's not, well, it might be the case again. It's coming back up again. I know you roll your eyes in, and me too. It's just more drama, right? But we're also in the post-Me Too era. And so I'm curious what you think, because Me Too comes, it's now very politically charged, right? And so is there a way, though, because there are this has been one of my criticisms of Me Too, how it unfolded, was that it became politicized, and it used this huge umbrella to define sexual assault and sexual harassment, and kind of conflated the two of them together, which really, I would say, denied those that actually had been victimized a platform, because it all got rolled into one and it became politicized. What role do you think Me Too will play in a story like the untested rape kits? Is there a place for that? Can it be leveraged for that? That's a big question. Just give me your thoughts.
Well, I'm of two minds about the Me Too movement. On one hand, I think that, yes, it is extraordinarily overly politicized. I think that when things like that turn into hashtags, they end up making mountains out of molehills. Do I think that it unearthed some things that needed to be unearthed? Sure. But do I think that there were folks who were caught up in the frenzy who really didn't do anything that would be considered that outrageous given the time, place, circumstance, or whatever? Yeah, I do. And I also think that the Me Too movement had the effect of demonizing men in general as being these evil, horrible attackers, when quite frankly, females can be just as equally vicious and evil. And I've seen it firsthand.
Your reporting has actually uncovered some of this, at least on the teacher-student front.
Yes. I mean, here we have, I've been tracking teacher arrests in North Carolina probably for the last 3 to 4 years now. And in that tracking, I have learned one thing, that the news media will report it like it's a weather report, or they will report it like it's sensationalized. Something like young hot teacher, you know, bag right. stud in science room. You know, I'm thinking to myself, this was rape, people.
Yeah, there's a double standard when it comes to male-female dynamics in those schools.
Yes.
And I think that's something that is a broader question that needs to be addressed, not only by our culture, but the school
almost weekly during the school year, I am reporting on at least one teacher arrest or someone who's been suspended.
Why do you think this is such a? Do you think this is just a matter of it's being reported now, or is this a rising phenomenon in schools?
Oh no, it's been reported all along. If you go back and you look, outlets have reported this. It just hasn't gotten the same sensationalism because these are teachers, and nobody wants to demonize a teacher. I don't want to demonize a teacher. These are very specific people operating in a teacher pool, okay? But put it that way, first of all.
But why is this phenomenon of students engaging in sexual acts with teachers, why is this? Because I think it's on the uptick, and I have my own theories about why that is. But do you think this is something that's happening more and more
yes.
within the schools?
I think it's happening with more frequency in schools, and we're finding out about it with more frequency.
Is it because of social media is one?
Social media, yeah. Social media.
But
has
why would a because I look at these pictures and I see oftentimes very attractive 20-something-year-old females mm-hmm. who are getting mixed up with kids as young as middle school.
Yeah, there.
What's the attraction there? I have my own theories on that, but what do you think, AP, is the attraction there? I know we're dovetailing a little bit off our main topic, but
it'll
be interesting to, I think, the listeners. What is the attractive of a 24-year-old teacher, a very attractive 25-year-old teacher, to a 14-year-old boy? What is the connection going on there? What's sparking that?
Honestly?
Especially since some of them are married.
Honestly, I'm not 100% sure what's going through some of these women's minds. Did no one suggest to them at some point that, you know, sleeping with your student is a bad thing? That you're in a position of authority, that you're an adult, they are a minor? I mean, does this not cross their mind at all?
No, I think it crosses their mind, but I think there's something that pushes them to a deeper level that they kind of, that clouds out of their conscious, so to speak. I mean, they know it's wrong from a law enforcement standpoint, but honestly, the penalties haven't been catastrophic for a lot of women in the school system as it has been, and it should be, for men, you know, that are doing the same thing.
But, oh, yeah, men are by far given harsher penalties than women are in these cases. The women in these cases are often let off with
probation. And, you know, they do have to register for sex offender, but sometimes that's not a lifetime thing.
But societally, we wink at it. Yeah. You know, there is this double standard. You guys have already iterated that. Mm-hmm. And that is indicative of I would say the disordered understanding of healthy sexual relationships that should only occur between consenting adults, right? And we've got the porn culture. We've got this, we've got the social media porn access that children are being exposed to, that young women are being exposed to. And I think it removes these barriers that society used to have in place that it no longer does, because it's just so accessible. Porn has taken, you know, it's just so debased. And there are a lot of factors, but I scratch my head too. I'm kind of like you. I don't know what's going through their minds.
There's no mentoring in place for any of these teachers either. There's no older teacher that's you know, standing next to them saying, yeah, not a smart idea. You know, I mean, it's like that police song, "Don't Stand So Close to Me." That's about a teacher who finds a young student attractive and he doesn't know what to do about it. That whole song is about that, but it's also about running away from that and recognizing that that's not a healthy thing. And I think that we don't have any kind of, we've got all this social justice training going on in our schools. You know, we have to be inclusive about this. We have to be sensitive about that. We have to look at this in a certain light. We have to look at that in a certain light. And nobody is talking about the elephant in the room that, you know, Johnny Joe and Bobby Sue over there are both, you know, sexting with their English language arts teacher on the side, you know. And when they do get exposed for that sort of thing, in the past, teachers were allowed to basically resign and move on to a different district. It was a practice called pass the trash. And legislation in the last 2 years has made it so that if a teacher resigns her post without giving at least 30 days notice, she can be actually terminated by the district if the superintendent wants to, or can be just, you know, outright fired if they really want to go that route. Now, if that resignation is in tandem, or early resignation is in tandem with a arrest or any kind of investigation going on into them, they can be suspended with or without pay by the superintendent. It's at their discretion. I've yet to see any superintendents really using that discretion yet. I see a lot of them suspending with pay pending an investigation. And honestly, that's the safe way to go, because, you know, there could be it could snap back as a lawsuit that it could turn out to be a false claim. And then the teacher's got a case against the state and you're going to have a giant payout. So I understand the process behind it. But when there is evidence, and in the case, maybe perhaps a rape kit has been done, you know, and now it's in a backlog. That case can take years to go through the system. Meanwhile, we've suspended this person with pay indefinitely pending the investigation. So for 2 years, this teacher's sitting there being paid to sit at home or to do something else. They may or may not be guilty. And there we have another part of the system being gummed up because these rape kits are not being processed. You know, so, I mean, there's that variable in there. But you know, there's no statewide system for background checks in North Carolina. Each district is doing it hodgepodge or whichever way they want to. We really need a uniform system of that. We need, they need to be performed every couple of years. And these teachers, there needs to be more accountability for this. When a teacher gets caught pulling this stuff, They should not only have their license immediately revoked, you know, upon conviction, but there should be deeper penalties for these things. These are teachers using their position of authority with a child in their care. You know, how many parents send their children off to school to go have sexting sessions with their teacher? I mean, come on. What are we talking about here? So, you know, there is a link between Me Too, between, you know, public safety, between the rape kits, and between this kind of behavior that we're seeing in our schools. And it's not getting the attention that it should. Maybe if these people were wearing a cleric collar, we'd have a national craze on our hands here, and maybe we'd have a movie like Spotlight being made about it, but we don't.
You hit the nail on the head there, and that actually crossed my mind too. If we dealt with this with the same gravity and severity that we are now finally coming to terms with in Catholic and Protestant churches, I think we'd see some movement on this. And this really is a come to Jesus moment that we need to have. But we really appreciate you taking the time to provide fuller context for us and weave this together, because it's important. And if any of our listeners are like us, where you probably know someone or you yourself have been the victim of this sort of assault, it hits home at a deeper level, and you understand fully the sad implications of not getting these kits tested. And so something needs to be done. So thank you for covering this and joining us to tell us about it.
Well, thank you for having me. I think it's really important to get this kind of thing into the public spotlight more, especially heading into election year, because these folks who are going to be in the next cycle will be the ones responsible for picking up the mantle. So people who are running for office, who are not currently in office, should be asked about this. And our current office holders should be asked about this, including our governor, who was the one who oversaw this division before he took the role of governor. And I think our media has been lax in asking him that question.
That's a good point. And just as a comparison, our neighbors to the north, Virginia, they have 2,369 untested rape kits, according to inthebacklog.org. And our neighbors to the south, South Carolina, they're reporting 813 untested rape kits in that state. So that gives you a little perspective of two states that we neighbor. And some states on their list do report zero, especially in the Midwest. There seems to be a number of states that are reporting zero.
Well, that's probably also population related too. I would imagine that there are places that were more populated probably have more of a backlog.
Yes, North Carolina is number one. And, you know, a state, just for example, Texas, you know, that's much, much higher than North Carolina. They report 2,138. So there's quite a difference nationally when you go on inthebacklog.org and look at the state-by-state comparisons. You can also break down some of the larger cities in the country that are notorious for issues. But we thank you. This is Brooke Medina, AP Dillon, and Ray Notestein, and I hope you all have a great week.